Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the last day of March, March 31st. As everybody gets ready for the Final Four coming up this weekend, we're going to be looking at a number of issues this hour. Our guest is going to examine how colleges are recruiting athletes. The NCAA has lowered the legal level for recruiting basketball players to the seventh grade, which is hard to believe. You don't even know how skilled they're going to become or how tall they will be by the time they are seniors in high school. Also, top-seeded Connecticut is facing an NCAA investigation following a Yahoo Sports report that alleges the former player Nate Miles received improper benefits, including lodging and transportation, from a former student manager turned player agent, and that the University of Connecticut staff made more than 1,500 phone calls to Miles and his representatives. Holy Toledo. That took up a lot of time, didn't it? We're also going to look at the broader question here of how many rule violations are there really? Are they fairly rampant? What about the gifts that players may receive, the shoes being taken care of, surgery being paid for if you need surgery, which has also been alleged in this Connecticut case? Do people bend the rules in order to win games, because winning games results in colleges and universities taking in one heck of a lot of money? I mean, a heck of a lot of money. And that's evidenced by what you see when you compare basketball coaches' salaries to the university president. You know, it's quite a thing here. And then the other issue too, which is whether or not the athletes who are playing for these schools should be students, and by that meaning following a fairly rigorous curriculum and not one that is designed just for athletes, which may not be exactly what other students are required to do. So all those issues on the table this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Dr. Alan Sack. He is a professor of management at the University of New Haven and director of the Institute for Sports Management, School of Business at the same university. He's author of Counterfeit Amateurs, An Athlete's Journey Through the 60s to the Age of Academic Capitalism, a founding member of the Drake Group and a linebacker on the 1966 National Champion University of Notre Dame football team. We'll also be taking phone calls for Professor Sack. Our number, emails, and that's talk@wpr.org. Professor Alan Sack, hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing actually very, very well.
Good.
Sunny day.
Looks like
spring's coming, finally.
Oh, my gosh. I'm in the wrong place. Yeah, we're kind of dreary, and we have snow on the ground from a couple days ago. Where are you?
Oh, in Connecticut, New Haven, Connecticut.
Oh, you're in Connecticut.
And it's been a long winter. It really has.
Yeah, I know. It sure has been. Well, let me ask you a general question to start here. Are rules violations, do you think, when it comes to basketball, which we're concentrating on because of the Final Four, or maybe other sports, pretty rampant in colleges and universities around the country, and it's just something that's under the table?
I did a study about 15, 20 years ago where I actually got access to over 1,000 NFL football players. They were current and they were former NFL football players, and the National Football League Players Association was willing to help me out with this study. And I was able to send out a questionnaire to, I actually got 1,200 responses from these guys, which
Wow.
was incredible. It really was incredible. Got a lot of press attention at the time. But to answer your question, one of the questions I asked is, did you ever, while you were in college, engage in a behavior that violated an NCAA regulation? And in particular, I asked them, did they ever take under-the-table money, kind of financial benefits, while mm-hmm. they were there?
Mm-hmm.
I got, in the Southeast Conference, I got like 55% of the athletes saying, yeah, they did.
Wow.
Overall, it was around 50%. And the most amazing part of it all to me was that when I asked them, do you think there's anything wrong with athletes getting a stipend in addition to the NCAA's, you know, that goes beyond the rules, but it's not a major thing, not millions of dollars. Do you think it's a reasonable thing for athletes to be able to have their living expenses paid for, even if it's violating the rules? I got 70% of the athletes saying, yeah, they think it's perfectly reasonable.
Wow.
So to answer your question, I think there's a vast underground payment system. Of course there is. That thing at UConn is just a drop in the bucket, and to focus on that is kind of like distracting from the larger issues. It's widespread. And there are very good reasons for why it would be. And it was even when I was playing in 1966.
Was it?
But But it's gone far beyond that now.
Yeah. And the reasons, I would imagine, one of the basic reasons is that these sports are bringing in lots and lots of money to the colleges and universities. A lot of money.
Yeah, I feel sorry for the coaches. I mean, the college coaches today are being put in a very difficult situation. On the one hand, they're really coaching professional college football and basketball. Mm-hmm. That's what it comes down to. And therefore, the criterion for maintaining your job is winning. Mm-hmm. Tyrone Willingham lost 3 years. He was out of here. Mm-hmm. You know, they fire you if you don't win. And on the other hand, they're telling these athletes that they have to have, they have an APR in the NCAA where you have to maintain certain grade point averages. And trying to win and have athletes who are going to be able to come up to the same standards as the rest of the student body is a very difficult, if not impossible, thing to do. Therefore, you're trying to win. You're putting a lot of pressure on the athletes. The athletes that you're putting a lot of pressure on aren't such good students to begin with sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you're going to run into problems of maybe recruiting, special admits. You're going to start compromising academic principles. And maybe, when you're really desperate, you're going to go out there and violate those recruiting rules, too, calling the kids 1,000 times rather than 3 like you're supposed to, you know.
Right.
And it all starts at the top, though. It's not the bottom. And I get upset when we talk about the bad apple theory. That's just this one kid or this one athlete, one young lady. Well, that's ridiculous.
Right.
We're talking about starting right at the college presidents and the boards of governors who have put this highly professionalized and commercialized system of mass entertainment mm-hmm. into place on America's college campuses.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't make sense. You're not judging how well the students do. You're not looking at their grade point at all, are you?
You have to a little bit. The problem is that if you look too closely, though, how are you going to win? I mean, we're talking about problems at UConn. I think the biggest problem at UConn is that they have a 75% federal graduation rate for their student body. That's not bad. That's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal graduation rate for the basketball team is 25%.
No. Yes, oh, no.
And no one talks about that. No one talks about it. The national championship football team this year, which was the University of Florida, has an 81% graduation, a federal graduation rate for the general student body. It is a fine university. It really is. It has a lot of standards. But the federal graduation rate for the football team was 35%.
Oh, my
gosh. Oklahoma
was
also 35%, and no one's talking about that.
That is astounding. Well, what do you think? Maybe we should just play everything straight and say, okay, maybe you don't meet the academic standards. We're just going to hire you to play football or basketball, and you can be separate from the academic coursework.
No, they're almost there already. And let me just interject one thing. I'm not saying that the athletes are dumb, and I don't think I've ever met, honestly, people disagree with me. I've never met a dumb jock. You know, I think they have to be very bright to be able to handle Charlie Weiss's playbook or to handle the kind of situations that these athletes have to handle. They have to be smart.
Mm-hmm.
But their main goal in life, and many times, not always, and I don't want to overgeneralize here, but oftentimes the main goal is to be a professional athlete.
Yeah, sure.
And
they're going to college
to be a professional athlete. And what has happened in the last couple of decades is that universities have changed their mission. The mission of, I think, a university is not to create athletes, but well-educated citizens whose educations are furthered by their performance on the athletic field. All right? That's a good way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's been a shift here, a major shift, a tectonic shift in the last 3 decades, especially to the point where I think universities are in the business of making professional athletes. They're creating athletes, and the athletes are coming in with primarily in mind that they'd like to play on Sundays if they're football players or in the NBA.
Yeah.
Is that bad? I don't know if it's bad or good, but I know it's not consistent with the existing mission of a university.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about when you were at Notre Dame. I must tell you that Notre Dame football was a religion in my household. You couldn't talk when Notre Dame was playing. All the family members would call each other to see how Notre Dame did. And I'll never forget this day in my life. When my dad was dying, he was not conscious, and Notre Dame was on. I turned it on, and here I am doing the play-by-play of the Notre Dame game for my dad because I knew if he could hear anything, that's what he wanted to hear at that
point
in time.
And there were probably thousands of others doing a similar thing.
I know. It was a day I'll always remember. But when you were – was that going on? You mentioned that some of it was. Tell me how scaled back it was when you were on the University of Notre Dame football team.
Little things with that are actually gigantic when you think about it. There was no freshman football when I played at Notre Dame because they really believed that we needed a year to adjust to that kind of demanding regimen. And they also wanted to find out if we were at Notre Dame to be students or whether we were there to be athletes. And sitting out a year, kind of, you had to prove yourself as being a student. Today, a young person, it happens quite often, is not only eligible as a freshman to play. In other words, you know, a college football player, a freshman college football player, can be playing on national television in the fall before they've entered the classroom for the first time. And that young man may not have the kind of background and educationally that I did 40 years ago. This is a big, big change. Now, you can actually, some of the athletes are leaving high school midway through the senior year and graduating from high school so that they can go to the college or university and be involved in spring practice at that university.
Oh my.
And now it's not only freshman eligibility, but it's like second semester high school kids who are now out there preparing to play as freshmen when they go to college. So what a fantastic difference. And there are many other differences like that that make someone who's been close to it as I have, you know, a lot of people don't realize these changes have taken place. But I've watched it for 40 years, you know, as a college professor, as an activist, and as a former athlete myself. And I see gigantic, gigantic changes in the nature of big-time college sports. Big time, you know.
Right.
There's still Division III, and there's still amateur sport out there. But the big-time sports is truly is professional.
And tell me, it's even reflected in when you look at salaries. We were talking in the family about this last night. I had no idea that somebody like Jim Calhoun, and I'm just singling him out because he's all over the place these days.
He's in the news now. Yeah.
He's making millions of dollars, and I wonder how much the president of the University of Connecticut is making. There's a huge disparity in salaries, isn't there?
Ara Parsegian, who was my coach back in the 1960s, he came into the university, and I interviewed him for my book, and I asked him this question, how much was he making when he came from Northwestern? He was making $21,000 a year when he came from Northwestern. When he left in 1974 from Notre Dame, having won two national championships, he was making $40,000 a year.
Oh, my.
And Charlie Weiss today is making over $3 million a year. So it's absolutely incredible. And to tell you the truth, though, I'm going to be very honest with you, I don't begrudge Charlie Weiss, nor do I begrudge a Calhoun his multi-million dollar salary, really, because they've been transformed into professional coaches.
Mm-hmm.
What I do get upset about, in other words, they're interchangeable. They can go off and play for, they could coach for the Eagles or for the Chicago Bears and come back and teach in colleges. We've transformed this thing into professional sports with the similar kinds of pressures, and the coaches deserve to be paid, I mean, in a free enterprise system. My concern is, why does Charlie Weiss or why does Calhoun make that kind of money? But the guys who are out there right now in the Final Four or in the championship March Madness who are wearing the sneakers with the logos on them, who are out there advertising for these big corporate sponsors, who are putting people in the seats and in front of their television sets and making millions for the universities, why are they treated like criminals like this young man from UConn who they buy him a sandwich someplace?
Right.
That kind of bothers me a little.
Yeah, I see your point.
I don't think rule breaking is right, but there is an inequity here in terms of transforming college athletes into employees, more or less, and treating them truly like criminals for minor violations.
Interesting. So they are. Essentially, they're not students. They're employees.
Well, they are students, though, by virtue of the fact that they're registered at that university. They become students. The question, are they good students? And secondly, is the other job that they do almost full-time, which is being a professional college athlete, is that consistent with trying to be a student at the same time?
Yeah.
So I'm giving you a little more, I think, a subtle look at this thing, you know. But I think it is a more complicated issue than oftentimes we think.
What's this story about recruiting? The Times had this interesting piece a couple weeks ago. What's this story about looking at, who's looking at seventh graders?
Man, in my book I mentioned that. Honestly, this is true. When I was in seventh grade, I was out shooting my BB gun out in the woods, you know.
Well, that wasn't good.
Killing a sparrow every once in a while, which was not good from an animal rights point of view.
Right.
And I felt bad about it when I shot one. You know, but I was doing that. Plus, I was playing a little Little League baseball. I was playing sandlot baseball. I was just starting to play a little basketball, you know, and I was having fun, you know. did somebody, if someone had shown up at my door at that point in my life when I was in seventh grade and said, or sent me something that you can play for us at, you know, University of North Carolina or Florida, what have you, what would that have done to my youth and my sports? And I believe that it would have taken the joy out of those when I was in that age, seventh and eighth and ninth grade, when I played just for the sheer joy of it. And I wasn't thinking about going to college. I wasn't thinking about getting a scholarship. I think we're starting to rob young kids of that kind of joy of playing the games that have meant so much to me throughout my entire life.
Well, you didn't even know how skills are going to develop after seventh grade, do you? And particularly basketball, it helps. It's not necessary, but it helps to be kind of tall. And some of these young people are, you know, barely 5 feet, some of the guys at that age.
For God's sake, they're doing genetic testing now to see what is likely.
Oh, no.
They're looking at the parents and the families to find out what the families are like. They're getting, you know, I call it the rationalization of, and there's a more technical scientific approach. Not unlike what they were doing in Russia and in Bulgaria, you know, in the Soviet Empire, you know. That was more extreme, certainly.
Right.
But we are looking more carefully now at a younger age to develop high, world-class athletes. The problem is, that's a problem, taking kids' youth away from them. But a bigger problem from my point of view in terms of what we're talking about right now is that we're doing this player development through our educational system. Whereas no other place in the world do they do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's only in the United States where our universities have large stadiums right in the middle of the campus, casting shadows on the classrooms, literally. So we have taken on the production of a professional athlete as one of the functions of a university, and then we try to deny we're not doing it. I simply wish we'd be honest, and you mentioned that a minute ago. I just wish we'd be honest and say, yeah, that's what we're doing. We're committed to that. We want to entertain the public,
right.
And we're going to try to give the athletes the best possible deal, including an educational deal, that we can.
Well, why don't we do that?
It would admit that it's not amateur.
Oh.
And again, I call my book Counterfeit Amateurism. I talk with Miles Brand, who I respect, and I think he's a brilliant mind. He's the president of the NCAA. And I had the privilege of interviewing him for my book, and that was really wonderful and to take the time. And really, at one point we were talking, and he actually said to me, he said, well, maybe this notion of amateurism has really outlived its usefulness in the 21st century, that it's a late 19th century concept, and it doesn't really fit that well. He was being very nice now. We were just talking cordially about this, and I think he was maybe admit that if you were sitting down having a beer with you someplace, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, well, if that's true, why not just drop the term altogether? And then I said, wouldn't there be legal consequences? And he says, well, maybe. And then he said, but we could always invent another term. We're good at that at the NCAA. We were joking around now. He was being lighthearted, too. But the point is, he knew and I knew that the legal consequences of eliminating that term would be gigantic.
Mm.
It would open up the NCAA to the Internal Revenue Service.
Oh.
It would make their revenue taxable from the NCAA,
sure.
$6 billion.
Oh, interesting.
The one defense that the NCAA has, the shield that they've used to keep away the IRS, to stop kids from having workers' compensation suits, from keeping the salary cap on how much the athletes are allowed to take in from their contributions on the athletic field, the shield to that has always been to say, this is amateurism. We are the NCAA, and we are the final moral authorities on determining what amateurism really is. If they do away with the concept, it would be damaging, probably a death blow to big-time college sports as we know it, honestly.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. We have one line open if you're trying to reach us. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. Professor Alan Sack, professor of management at the University of New Haven, where he's also director of the Institute for Sports Management, author Counterfeit Amateurs, An Athlete's Journey Through the 60s to the Age of Academic Capitalism. He's a founding member of the Drake Group and a linebacker on the 1966 national champion University of Notre Dame football team. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, to your phone calls, starting with Mike from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So many questions. I'll just narrow it to two. Let me just mention this. I have never heard of the University of Connecticut, where you know this mini scandal is going on right now. I understand that the player actually never played for the team, but it seems to me that UConn, you know, and schools like that have been able to upgrade campus facilities, have been able to you know upgrade programs, bring in better staff, and so if Jim Calhoun, the coach of that basketball team, if he can demonstrate, which he probably can, that the school has been better since he was there, because he actually built that program there. Mm-hmm. But let me ask you this really quickly, though. Is there a ACT/SAT score exemption for these athletes? Because I can't see how, if I understood how it was laid out, I don't see how a person with a seventh grade skill level could actually pass the ACT or SAT. And you mentioned that your guest is from Notre Dame. And I was wondering, too, very quickly, why isn't Notre Dame mentioned in the NCAA championship, football championships conversation anymore? Not since Lou Holtz was the coach, in fact. And I was wondering if Notre Dame raised its academic standards and have since suffered for it. Thank you for taking my call.
All right, thanks for the call.
Very nice questions. On number one, the SAT thing. There used to be a thing called Proposition 48 in 1986, I think it was put into effect, which set a floor on how low your SAT scores could be, or your ACT scores. And that floor was, in today's terms, it would be 820. In other words, you could get, if you at least got an 820 in your SATs, combined scores, both math and verbal, then that satisfied the SAT requirement for the NCAA eligibility. There are other requirements as well, grade point average in certain kinds of core courses. What has happened only a couple of years ago, in part because of the outrage of many African Americans and the feeling that maybe that test is biased, the NCAA or whatever, the NCAA has decided to play down the importance of the SAT so that now they have what is called a sliding scale. And I don't want to get too technical, but the sliding scale means that if you have a very low SAT score, and I mean 400, that's as low as you can get, if you can balance out that 400 with an A in the high school grade point average, then you're eligible. But that's not likely to happen. But more likely would be having a 600 SAT, all right, average in math and verbal, and balancing that with a B. So now you can envision, here is a young man or a young woman going into a very highly competitive school with a combined SAT score of 600. That's, to me, I believe that suggests that there was a lack of adequate undergraduate education, high school education, elementary school education. That young that person is going to be behind in reading and in math, and they're going to have a hard time catching up. So my answer to you is on the first question is I think that the standards have dropped somewhat, in fact, for the athletes, and that they're recruiting kids who are special admits, they call them, more and more. And you'd find that many of those students at UConn probably are special admits. But let's not just jump on UConn. That would be an error. This is a nationwide problem.
Right.
And you're just trying to win games so that they can bring in the revenue and the other things that the gentleman was talking about on the phone. Secondly, it was the question about Notre Dame and why are they losing. I talked about federal graduation rates a moment ago. At Notre Dame, as opposed to Florida, Notre Dame's overall federal graduation rate for the student body is somewhere around 90, 92, 93%. They're right at the very top. They really are. Their football federal graduation rate is 85%. Now, a little lower, but not much. And I know a lot of Notre Dame people are going to hate me for saying this, but I don't believe that Notre Dame is going to be able to get back into the competition until I start seeing a greater gap developing between their general student body and the athletes. I do believe that Notre Dame, Duke, Stanford, and some other schools where that gap is quite small have a much harder time competing for the bowl championship series and other venues because of that.
Well, so I have to ask the question, is there a real shortage of smart athletes in this country?
There's a shortage of, how many students who are going to universities have very high kinds of board scores and other admission standards that they can meet, like at Stanford. But they also they're just tremendous athletes. There's a certain number who combine both, but
right,
you would imagine there'll be fewer. In the same sense, to be perfectly fair, you allow a cellist or a violinist or something into the university,
it's not going to be that easy to find those really wonderful cellists who are also at the very top of Harvard's entering class. They're going to have to lower their standards a bit. But the lowering of the standards in athletics, especially football and basketball, is truly extraordinary. Extraordinary.
Yeah. Let's go to
Rob. By the way, he also asked me about Lou Holtz.
Oh, right.
You know what happened?
No, tell me.
Lou Holtz came in 1985, just after Jerry Faust left. Jerry Faust, they used to make fun of him, saying that all he recruited was like choir boys. You know, choir boys. They were such nice kids. And while Jerry Faust was at Notre Dame had the highest graduation, federal graduation rate for its football team on a number of years that he was there than the rest of the country. When Lou Holtz came in, that federal graduation rate started to go from 85, and when he left, I think some might say he was kind of given a little shove out, even though he was doing wonderfully in sports, that rate had fallen down to 73%. Mm. So did they lower standards during that period? Lou Holtz that was there for 3 years, and when it turned over, and he had admitted the first Prop 48 kids that had ever been admitted to Notre Dame, and also won the national championship in 1988. Maybe that's all coincidence.
Yeah,
maybe it's
I think
total
so.
Coincidence,
huh?
Honestly, you know?
Right, right.
But something
sure
tells
it
me it's not.
Yeah, Robert from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Professor. My thoughts do not pertain to the lowering of standards. I guess I'm interested in the possibility of maintaining that student-athlete ideal. You know, people go to college to become doctors. They take courses that are focused on medicine. People go to school or college to become English teachers. They take courses in education in English. How about a curriculum, a major in being a professional athlete? You know, you read about these guys who 5 years after their career is over, are down and out. They've squandered all their money. You know, courses in finance, courses in kinesiology, courses in the psychology of hangers-on, et cetera.
Well, right now, you could say, and I'm involved in the sport management program, and there are many very rigorous sport management programs in the country, and they're becoming more so as more of them move into the colleges of business. Because we understand that sports is a major business. So your idea is, in fact, a good one, but it's already been done in many ways. I think an athlete who goes into a very good sport management program in a very good business school is going to come out with the kind of skills you're talking about. But it's a different thing to say, let's have a major in big-time college football, where the major curriculum is learning how to play the game, developing the skills, and so forth. I wouldn't buy that, and I don't think most faculty senates in the country would buy that. So I think, well, we're also talking about an extracurricular activity. Football is an extracurricular activity. Your point, I'd actually go along with this one, maybe. If someone could say, and if universities start accepting, that football is really part of the curriculum, playing the game of football is part of the curriculum, get it into the curriculum, award college credit for it, at least it wouldn't be hypocritical anymore, and we'd be admitting we are now in the business of creating professional college athletes, and we're going to give them all the training they need. We're not there yet, but we could be there. I hope we don't go there, but at least if we did, it wouldn't be hypocritical anymore.
What do you think, Robert? Should we go there?
Well, I don't know if the professor, if I've spoken clearly, but I'm not talking about playing professional football or basketball as a major or being in management, but actually a major in, you know, just like you go to school to become an English teacher,
yes,
become a doctor, you become a professional athlete. You are being a professional athlete, and so you have to manage your finances. You have to take care of your body. You have to do all kinds of things which are specific to being a professional athlete.
No, I didn't make myself clear, and I apologize, but I do believe that the sport management curriculums that I know of actually involve sport finance. And they involve, I'd love to see a football player negotiating his own contract or a basketball player negotiating her own contract in a finance class as part of a project. I agree with you on that every bit. I do believe that curriculum does exist. It involves issues about sports medicine. You can take electives to find out more about that. I think you could put together that kind of a curriculum. And I just wanted to make the distinction, and you agree with me. I think the caller agrees with me on this. He's not talking about just the skills of football. He's saying things that go along with which are also academic type things, such as business education and the other thing, sports medicine. That's a possibility, yes.
Yeah. Thanks, Robert, for the call. John is next from Milwaukee. Hello, John.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
We had Al McGuire here in Milwaukee, head basketball coach for Marquette. And in 1968, he made the observation that by the year 2015, all big-time college sports and their programs will be defunct, and primarily because of the absolute insanity and greed and lack of concern for the athletes themselves that these programs show. In fact, McGuire himself acknowledged that he was part of the problem. And these students, they're not even students, just are used, their bodies on the floor. We know from Sunday's interview with LeBron James that he was scouted in the seventh grade by the NBA. And it's just a tragedy that these children, and in fact they are children, have absolutely no idea about how bad they're being exploited.
I tend to agree, except I have one point I'd like to add here. Talking about big-time college sports as being defunct would be kind a bit of an overstatement. It may not be fulfilling its educational responsibility, but as an entertainment industry, I think it's really thriving. I think that people rally around the big-time college sports in a way that probably is more popular than bona fide professional sports. March Madness is truly madness. The collective euphoria that we're talking about, the money that does flow into the communities as a consequence of these big-time entertainment festival-like events. So big-time college sports has become a highly successful form of mass commercial entertainment. Basketball and football have both done that. Now, the real question is, what has the consequence been for the athletes in terms of their education? And I believe it's been very, very, very negative. And the question is, does the positive side, entertaining the general public, the whole nation's euphoria about sports, as well as much of the economic impact that it has for universities and their communities, does that justify the fact that we are not really educating the athletes as we should be, from my point, in my own humble opinion?
Yeah. Well, and the other way to look at some of this is some of these kids are from, economically disadvantaged areas. There are a lot of city kids who go into playing basketball because they play it on the streets of where they happen to live. And they're being taken care of for the first time in their lives in terms of money, right? The schools will send them home for their family celebrations. They're getting nice shoes. They're getting medical care, et cetera. People are taking them under their wings, maybe exploiting them, but also taking care of them.
Room, board, tuition, and fees, the salary cap.
You got it.
And when I first got my scholarship back in the 1960s, I got room, board, tuition, and fees, and laundry money. They've cut laundry money, for God's sake. Can you imagine that? They took that away. Yeah, so they are. Yes, and by the way, I don't want to make fun of a scholarship is a lot of money.
Yeah.
It could be $40,000, $50,000 a year these days. I mean, it's off a year. You know, it's incredible. So it's not an insignificant amount of money. On the other hand, that scholarship is supposed to also, a large amount of it is for tuition. And that means you're getting an education as a part of this.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're getting room, board, tuition, and fees, and that tuition money is really not really paying for anything other than education light, is what I call it.
Right.
You know, you just get by and stay eligible, then I think the athlete probably is being exploited in that regard.
Yeah.
By the way, it is pay, and I wanted to make that point that oftentimes we talk about, and I heard in your little break a minute ago, you're going to talk about should college athletes be paid. I don't debate that anymore. The college athletes are already paid. They're paid room, board, tuition, and fees, a one-year renewable scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And the real question is, do they deserve to be paid more? Now, that gets into a very fascinating issue, right? That's the fascinating question I'd love to see debated more on. There are reasonable people who would say, no, they're getting enough now. They're getting room, board, tuition, and fees. They're being taken care of, as you just suggested. There are others who are saying that they are being substantially exploited by the system.
Right. And when it comes down to it, you talked about how smart a lot of these kids are. I fully agree with you. It really does take smarts to play any number of sports, in so many different kinds of intelligences, too. So a lot of these kids could be developed to be really, smart in academic pursuits, but all the emphasis also must be on, terribly long practices and not having a chance to focus as much on on going to school, and you need to be brought up to speed in that regard, and you don't have a chance to develop your smarts in other areas.
And the problem is that process you're talking about begins very young now.
Yes.
See, it's not just when you get to college. Now, right. When you're in third grade, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, this whole idea of I want to be like Michael Jordan, and I want to go off on a scholarship. Now, your whole life, you overemphasize the importance of sports in your future career and your future life. And I think that the colleges and universities are, and the media are really reinforcing that by athletic scholarships. And I'm so happy that Obama is now the president, because now we have a lot more kids out there who are saying, I want to be like Obama. You know, and what that means, they're probably going to fail to be the president, of course. Only, you know, one like being hit by lightning, the chance of becoming president. But when they fail to be the president, having tried all their lives to be one, that means they were left with skills like reading and writing and understanding of history and science and technology, all these other things, beyond what you learn on the athletic field. And when you try to be like Mike, you learn some very important lessons. You learn about competition. You learn about, I think he's a wonderful role model. But that's not sufficient to make it in this complex global economy that we're all trying to survive in.
Excellent point. Excellent. Thanks, John, very much for your call.
Yes,
let's pause for a moment, and we'll return and take more phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Alan Sack. He is a professor of management, University of New Haven, where he is also director of the Institute for Sports Management, which is in the School of Business. He's the author of Counterfeit Amateurs, An Athlete's Journey Through the 60s to the Age of Academic Capitalism, and is a former linebacker on the 1966 National Champion University of Notre Dame football team. We're looking, as we approach the NCAA Final Four this weekend, at how colleges recruit athletes, the privileges they may be given, whether or not they are students or are they amateurs. Our guests would indicate that they already are paid. The question is whether or not they should be paid more. So we're looking at all of this hour, disparity in salaries between university presidents and basketball coaches, and the complexity of this sports world, this amateur sports world. Okay, did I give you the number? 800-486-8655. You could send an email if you'd like. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, returning to your phone calls, Mark from Mequon is next. Hi, Mark.
Hello, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for the opportunity to speak to the professor. I would like to bring the issue down one more level to the high school. And what I mean by that is I would say all of the students in the school system at the grade school and high school level are paying the price to support these institutions. And what I mean by that exactly is I live in a community which is putting in artificial turf for their high school football team. They have an enormous field house for their basketball team that rivals many universities, and at the same time, they are cutting teachers, increasing class sizes, and cutting programs to the tune of over $1 million. But they will not cut any of these sports programs or even touch the sports programs. And we, as taxpayers, are supporting this mechanism where these athletes, which are a very small percentage, a minute percentage, who are ever going to make it to the level one NCAA or even have an opportunity to work in the pros, by supporting these programs with tax dollars. This is ridiculous, and I'd like to hear the professor's comment.
Okay, thank you.
No, very fine point. The Knight Foundation Commission, which is a very prestigious group of former college presidents, a lot of presidents emeriti, and so forth, has been very influential in looking at college sports and trying to reform it over the last 20 years. And one of their statements is that big-time college sports literally swamps academic values. And we're talking about at the college level. And then they have a whole section in one of their reports where they say that this is now happening at the high school level, that, in fact, what has used to be the problem in the college universities has now become a major problem at the high school level. You talk about facilities. I just read recently where they have one high school has a press box, which is three stories with an elevator.
Oh, no.
And they're seating like 20,000 people coming out for these games. And now high school football and basketball have become mass major entertainment industries of their own. They are on cable television. The national signing day for colleges and universities from high school. When a high school kid signs with a university, now they have it on television. It's broadcast around the entire country. There are specialized magazines and the whole thing. So the commercialism has seeped into, for sure, into the high school and into the junior high school level. When I was an expert witness for a case down in Tennessee where they were concerned that a coach from a private school was recruiting 7th and 8th graders, and he was recruiting them and talking to them about spring practice. Now, the recruiting was a big deal, but for me, I was like I was aghast to find out that they even had spring practice in football in 8th grade for 8th graders in football. I mean, the very fact that they're preparing the 8th grade students so that they can go and play with the 9th graders during the spring so they can be prepared for the 9th grade football team.
Mm.
Things have really, what's happened is that sports has become such a mania. It is such an incredible, overwhelming kind of thing for the American public that it is, in many instances, and I think the word swamping academic values at all levels is true, and draining resources away from other academic things into big stadiums, into the arms race that's going on at the college level and at the high school and even probably the elementary school level. I love sports. We should all be playing it at every level, but all kids should be involved, not just the elites.
Yes,
everyone stops and goes into a large stadium and watches once a week and then goes back to playing video games.
Right. I'm with you on that. Well, you've also got to look, and I'm sure you have, at the injury aspect of this. You could be burned out by the time you're a junior in high school.
It does happen quite. The burnout factor today, I think, has increased because very well-meaning and well-intentioned parents are starting their kids off on the scholarship dream. They didn't even mention it to the kids, but that's what's in the back of their mind.
Sure, sure.
And I can understand that. It's very expensive to go to college, and if you're young, your son or daughter has skills, you'd like to develop them. But I teach a lot of young athletes, and I have them write an essay for me when they come into my class to tell how they got involved in sports. And the idea of burnout comes up quite a bit. They talk about by the time that they were in the 11th grade, they'd already had enough. They were born with the father or mother putting a little cap on their head or a football helmet. They were only like 3 months old, and there were pictures all around the house of that. And from that point on, it was always sports, sports, sports. And at a certain point, they just said, I don't want to do this anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's go to Jim from Pleasant Prairie. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, and thank you for the excellent guest discussing this topic. I'm going to ask the guest if his book discusses that the University of Chicago dropped out of the Big Ten for largely the same set of subject that we're discussing this morning. And the other larger question I wanted to ask, I imagine his book does discuss, is that what does all of this has to say about our culture that we have these pro athletes that are masquerading as amateurs?
A major cultural shift, returning to the first question first about the Robert Hutchins at University of Chicago. Yeah, back in the 1930s, he became so concerned that commercialism in big-time college sports was really ruining the basic educational values of Chicago, which always had strong intellectual traditions, that he actually banned big-time college football at the University of Chicago and went off on his own. Amos Alonzo Stagg, who was their coach, was one of the winningest coaches in big-time college football at that time.
Huh.
And Chicago was one of the most famous of all the schools in that regard. He simply just cut the whole program.
Oh, my gosh.
He was also a supporter, however, of freedom of speech. He was in the McCarthy hearings. He was an outspoken advocate of academic freedom for faculty and an intellectual. So his value system, to kind of roll into the second question, his value system was one that said that the university was primarily a place to cultivate the life of the mind. It was primarily a place where sports, if it's there, should be an adjunct to the other things. It shouldn't be the center stage. And he was alone back then, and he would even be more alone today.
He sure
would
be.
Has there been a cultural shift? You know, I'm really going out on a limb on this one, but I have a feeling that the growth of highly professionalized college sports may actually be kind of symptomatic of a decline of the interest in the humanities and the arts and the sciences and the idea of a liberal education. And that may be happening at the same time here, that we're looking at a more vocationally oriented college or university where careers are the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Academic capitalism is what I talk about here, mm-hmm. bottom line concerns, and perhaps not as much as a concern in some universities with the development of a total human being who thinks about the ethical and the other kinds of important issues in international politics rather than simply in bottom of the line terms. So there could be something bigger taking place here too. And when I talked with Miles Brand, we both had the same book that we loved. Honest to God, even though we argued with each other on the phone, we both, our favorite book was Anti-Intellectualism in American Life by Richard Hofstadter, which was a Pulitzer Prize writer at the time. And Miles Brand liked it. I liked it too. The point he made, though, he says he believes that the University of Chicago model never was the model that fit the United States. It always was the big state university model that fit the United States, because we're a different country with more of a practical approach to education rather than intellectual one. Mm. I think those things are intertwined in this issue.
Well, Jim, that was a great thought and question. Do you have another one? It really was good.
Certainly stressed my mind.
Yeah, it was good. Thanks, Jim, so much for your call. Let's go next to Paul from La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, along that same vein, let's go back even farther. Amateur was just another way for saying racism way, way back in the day. It was for gentlemen, and you were a gentleman if you were white and if you could afford to play your sport. Avery Brundage, who was such a, in favor of amateurism in the Olympics, president of the Olympics, he was an absolute fraud. When he was jealous of Jim Thorpe, and he zealously attacked Jim Thorpe for being playing, minor league baseball, because he was jealous of him. It wasn't, the SEC, the Southeastern Conference, didn't integrate until they said, we have to get some of these black athletes. We can't let them go to Ohio State and Michigan. And the Big Ten schools were only letting African-Americans play since about the late 40s, early 50s. It's a sham. We've never had amateurism. And one point, Kathleen, George Gipp is the great inspiration of Notre Dame football. When he died, he was 26 years old. What's a 26-year-old man doing playing football at the University of Notre Dame? He was a fraud.
A pure amateur.
So we should never, ever think that amateurism ever existed except to be racist.
All right, let's put race in it. We've only got a couple of minutes left. That's a show.
I don't think it was just racist. I think it was also elitist. It is an elitist term, and it grows out of the early 19th century in Britain. And I think it was a term that was largely the creation of the British landed aristocracy, where you didn't have to work for a living. You kind of went out there and messed around in your garden. And if you worked, it was because you kind of liked to work, because you didn't have to work. And anyone who had to work for a living had to be, a lesser human being. So the caller is absolutely correct. There's a good deal of elitism in that notion. And I would also argue, and I'd have to admit, that the athletic scholarship system has led to a certain democratization of higher education. It's allowed people to go to me, for instance. I got an athletic scholarship. I came from a very lower class background. So this is a very complicated issue. However, I would make this point, and I wish I had more time to argue with the caller, over a beer someplace, but I do believe that if amateurism fits anywhere, it fits best in a university where college sports are supposed to be an extracurricular activity rather than the development of elite athletes. Amateurism is really hypocritical when your main goal is to develop the best athletes in the world, because you have to take time off to do that. You can't be working at some other job to do that. But in a university, sports is not supposed to be the center stage, and it's not supposed to be for training professionals. Now, if the university decide to change that and decide to openly admit, yes, we are training professionals, okay, that's what I said earlier, I'll go along with that. Mm-hmm. But it means we get rid of the term amateurism and let the chips fly where they may, to the IRS, to the federal government, to antitrust cases. It'll be phenomenal. But that was a good question, and it's a difficult one, and I didn't have time to work through it as I'd like.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of questions. Well, you were terrific. Thank you so much for being with us. Can you guide our eyes to something we ought to be looking at in the Final Four? Now it's going to be a whole new experience for me, I got to tell you.
Well, I was looking at the Final Four just before I got on the phone, and You know, got a couple of nice teams there in North Carolina. In terms of who's going to win, I couldn't tell you. You know, I'm a UConn person. But I could tell you about graduation rates.
North Carolina's
graduation rate, federal graduation rate for its basketball team is 64%. 64, that's pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
But you run into the same problem. The general graduation rate at North Carolina is 83%.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a gap there, and they're not really consistent with it. They're not, they don't fit the profile of the general student body, but that team is still pretty bright, right? Villanova is even closer, 77 graduation success, federal graduation rate for the players. That's high, 77%.
Yeah.
87 for the general student population. A very good school academically. UConn just does stand out. And I would be unfair just to say that UConn represents everyone. They have the 50% gap between ball players. And MSU has maybe a 7% gap. So the gaps aren't necessarily as large, as I said, all over the place. We have to be fair about that.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, there is that kind of a difference
and
lowering of standards.
Thank you so much for being with us. Great hour.
It was my pleasure.
Thanks. We'll have you on again. Professor Alan Sack, and his book is An Athlete's Journey Through the 60s to the Age of Academic Capitalism. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing the hour and John Treader for on-air production.